Thank you very much, Mr. Fauché. The shelling had continued through all day and all night. Cannons, rockets, bombs, every kind of possible weapon available at the time had been used. And throughout the night, in the light of that weaponry, soldiers and sailors were occasionally able to catch a glimpse of the Stars and Stripes flying over Fort McHenry in the Baltimore Harbor. But in the early dawn of September 14th, 1814, everybody sort of waited with anticipation because the shelling had come to an end. Quiet had sort of settled over the area, and it became rather dark before dawn. And nobody really knew how the battle had gone, that is, those from a distance. This, of course, was the War of 1812. America was at war with Britain again. Why Britain thought they'd do better the second time they did the first, I don't know. But they had chosen to try to take America back. And a young man named Francis Scott Key, a sailor, was sitting in the Baltimore Harbor on a frigate watching the battle through the night. The bombardment had lasted for 25 hours, but everybody waited to see what the final outcome had been and whether, when light came, the flag that flew over Fort McHenry would be the American flag or the Union Jack of Britain. And at first light, as the smoke cleared away, Francis Scott Key was able to see the enormous flag of the United States flying over the fort. He was inspired to immediately write a poem expressing his emotional reaction to that sight. I use the word inspired somewhat cautiously because the true meaning of the word would mean that God was involved. I don't know whether God was involved in the creation of this poem, but I could imagine that he might have been, even as he probably has been in some of the great literature and music down through the ages of man, because man of and by himself probably couldn't create all that he's created. But Francis Scott Key was moved, and he wrote a poem. And that poem later was set to music and became, of course, our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. If I ask how many of you can sing the Star-Spangled Banner, or at least know the words, most of you would raise your hand. But if I ask you, can you sing the second verse, most of you would not raise your hand. Some of us would even say, what second verse? How about the third verse? Or maybe the fourth? Because, in fact, the Star-Spangled Banner is four verses long. I'd like to quote the fourth verse for us here today. I'll skip over the second and third, assuming you know the first. But the fourth verse of the poem and the song goes like this. Oh, thus be it ever when free men shall stand between their loved home and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that has made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the Star-Spangled Banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. One thing I'd like for us to notice, of course, is that credit is given here to God for preserving the nation in that particular war. I think probably a lot of us think that the Star-Spangled Banner was written during the Revolutionary War, and that's not true. It was some 20 years later. But the song credits God in preserving the nation. And that sentiment, of course, was pretty common in those days of our nation. In fact, they were common at the founding of the nation. They were common in the during the War of 1812. And some still give that concept lip service today. That is, we may occasionally say, God is preserving our country. In fact, if you are a baseball fan, you are aware that pretty much ever since 9/11, every baseball game at what is called the seventh inning stretch, the changeover of the teams in the middle of the seventh inning, is accompanied by a soloist singing God Bless America. And we give lip service to the idea that God is, in fact, blessing America. We do the same thing with great anthems like America the Beautiful, in which we not only talk about the beauty of the land, but the fact that God shed his grace on thee, as we sing. God has shed his grace on America over and over again. There were lots of fireworks last night in the Katy area and probably wherever you happen to live. There are both kinds of fireworks in Katy last night, and I'll have to say that the natural fireworks completely overshadowed the man-made fireworks because there was a tremendous lightning storm right about 9 o'clock, just as it was getting good and dark, and they were starting the fireworks shows in most areas probably. We happened to be driving home after an afternoon at Julian Royden's and eating too much and enjoying our time together. We were driving home just about that time down the Katy Freeway, and you could see fireworks on the north and on the south and in the west out by Katy Mills Mall, which was, I guess, the biggest one around. In fact, I chose to take an earlier exit than the Katy Mills exit, which is my normal exit, because I was pretty sure it'd be clogged up. And sure enough, got down the service road, and as we approached Katy Mills exit, we could see that the exit was backed up onto the freeway. Quite a traffic jam even at that time with people still showing up to watch the fireworks. In fact, they weren't scheduled to begin, I think, until about 9:30. And we saw that there were hundreds of people gathered in viewing spots all over town. You know, the Walmart parking lot, the gas station, the closed bank. People had pulled out their lawn chairs and various things. And, of course, it was a very threatening weather pattern, as I've already mentioned, and yet people seemed to be unconcerned about that, and lots of children out there. And they were all waiting to watch the fireworks, or already watching fireworks from various locations. We got home, we went out on our back deck thinking we might be able to see some from there, but we could not see any from our place because we have too many tall trees right along the back. And so we could not see the fireworks from our place, so we didn't have that experience this year, but we have, of course, in many occasions in the past. But I had to wonder how many of these folks even know why we have fireworks on the 4th of July. Why do we have fireworks on the 4th of July? I especially wondered that when I considered that we use them for all sorts of events. We use them in football games. We use them after baseball games. We use them on New Year's Day. Lots of folks use them whenever they can pull them out of the closet, having had them left over from the last time that they bought fireworks. And you can tell by the major stands and even some large buildings that say fireworks for sale that it must be a rather popular pastime and a fairly lucrative one as well, because fireworks seem to be pretty much everywhere. Well, it doesn't take a lot of imagination, even if you hadn't thought about it, and you probably have, to realize that the fireworks were originally on the 4th of July a simulation of that battle for Fort McHenry, that battle in Baltimore Harbor when Francis Scott Key wrote the now famous words to the Star Spangled Banner. Of course, they then memorialize subsequent wars as well, which the United States has had plenty of, though not on our own soil, except for the Civil War, which may or may not be included in that particular demonstration of fireworks. But most of us see war, and when I say us, I mean our citizenry, the United States and our fellow man, see war as having been the means of protecting our freedom. Young people who go to war certainly believe that, or probably would not go to war. They believe that they are sacrificing their health and their lives for the freedom of the country, and that is the way they are generally promoted and supported. And the fact is, that's probably true to a certain degree, because when Israel ceased to allow God to fight their battles in days of old, God allowed them to fight their own battles, and he intervened as he saw fit when and where he chose. And no doubt God has still done that. Many of us older folks remember the stories during World War II of some of the miracles that occurred, like the evacuation of Dunkirk when the British Navy was basically completely at the mercy of the German forces. But the cloud cover came in, the fog completely covered them, and they were able to escape without the kind of damage that surely would have occurred otherwise. There are other stories like that that old soldiers can tell you all the time. So God is involved at some level in protecting us, no doubt, and God has chosen to bless us for his own purposes, as we'll see here in a few moments. So today, fireworks probably have very little meaning to most people. They're just kind of an exciting, happy, interesting time, maybe something to show the kids, maybe something to scare the kids. And again, nothing like the natural fireworks. I was walking up the walk out here on my way in from the car just before services. Jeff and Judy had already come in the door, and I was out maybe about halfway to the parking lot when that last great thunderclap hit, at least the last one I heard. Maybe you heard later ones, but I probably jumped 3 feet. It was so loud and so close, so sharp. You might as well have put a .45 beside my head and fired it by my ear. It was just remarkable how loud it was, and made me jump a long way. But God's fireworks are still a great deal greater than man's. So I don't know that fireworks should have a great deal of meaning today. I'm not promoting the idea that fireworks have deteriorated and therefore we have to restore the meaning of fireworks. That isn't my point today, but simply to acknowledge that most things that we have started for good and right purposes or traditions often lose their meaning and their purpose over time because we do not explain why we do what we do. And sometimes that's even true, of course, in the church. As Mr. Franks was saying, we have to preserve our doctrines and our understanding of what God has taught us. We have certainly as a nation, if not lost sight of the meaning for fireworks, we have lost sight of the source of our natural greatness, national greatness, sorry. We have lost sight of the source that made us who we are. We have lost sight of the fact that America is, as the politicians often use the word, an exceptional nation. That word exceptional has been used a lot over the past few years, and now we have to begin to ask ourselves, is America an exceptional nation? But why is America today still the greatest single nation the world has ever known? Why have we had a tradition of exceptionalism, which our current leadership, much of it, not only the president but others, seem to want to deny? Most of us sitting in this room know the general answers to those questions. We know why America is the single greatest nation on the face of the earth and has been for a couple of hundred years. We know that we are indeed an exceptional nation for spiritual reasons that God himself provided. But while America celebrates its independence, and that's of course what the name of the holiday really is, Independence Day. While America celebrates its independence with fireworks and maybe big discount sales that everybody rushes out to on either Friday or Sunday, or Saturday for most people, but for you and I, maybe we go to a major sale on a holiday like this because that's what we do in America. We create our big sales events on our holidays because people are off work and have an opportunity to come shopping. And spending money is our favorite pastime, except for receiving spent money from somebody else. So we like to spend and we like to receive what others spend. Now, while that's happening and America is going about its celebration, over the next couple of days they will still do so, we ought to remember why we have been blessed for over 200 years above all the nations of the earth. Very few people know the answers to those questions. Great statesmen and politicians and educators and religious leaders have no idea why America is different, why America has been and continues to be, regardless of what we might say, an exceptional nation in the world. So I don't want to belabor what many of us know well, which is why America is great. On the other hand, there are no doubt some among us who have only a cursory knowledge of why America is great, or perhaps a shallow understanding of the truth that the church has taught for decades of the true history of the United States. Even if we once knew the details, we may not be able to explain it to somebody else. So we want to make sure that we do not let these things slip. We don't want to let slip the things that God has revealed to us as a church. And so with the 4th of July holiday weekend upon us, I thought it's important to review some of the reasons that you and I already probably know. The simple fact is that America is an exceptional nation because the Creator God made it so. Our blessings have flowed from God as the fulfillment of His promises to Abraham. That goes back a long way. Thousands of years ago, God made promises to Abraham that we are beneficiaries of today. Now, this connection is virtually unknown to our fellow citizens, of course, but we should take time to thank God for where we live, how we live, and for Abraham's part in that provision, because Abraham certainly had a part, though ultimately the credit all goes to God. So let's quickly review this background of our national greatness. I won't be able today in this brief sermon time to cover the material and every detail thoroughly. That isn't my intent or purpose, but we do want to overview the major elements of this particular set of circumstances that brought America to where we are today. Because we as Christians have to know and we have to use that knowledge. We have to be able to serve God and worship God in the context of what He has done, not only for us personally in calling us to salvation, but what He has done for us as a nation and allowing us to live in this particular place. Back to Genesis chapter 12, of course, to the story of Abraham. I'm going to run through sort of chronological order here, the scriptures that relate to this subject. And if you haven't studied it recently, you may want to return to a study of it. You may want to review it. You may want to have it clearly in mind, because it does affect a lot of the things that the church teaches, a lot of the things the church practices, a lot of the understanding that we have of what's happening in the world today is based in this scenario of God promising Abraham certain things and then fulfilling them over thousands of years. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Eternal had said, and that's a proper translation because this is referring back to when Abram was in Ur of the Chaldees before he went to Haran. Now the Eternal had said to Abram, I'll put it that way. The Eternal had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. That's a pretty simple but blunt and very powerful statement. I will make you a great nation. Abram, whoever he was at that point in time, was living off in a very pagan part of the world, and the world as a whole was pagan, of course. Seemed to be nobody really obeying God, though God may have had somebody just prior to Abram who was functioning after the days of Noah, maybe Shem. We don't have a lot of information on that period of time. But he said, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So God said this to Abram apparently at the beginning. Now as we read the chronology, as we read the story, of course, Abram and his father Terah and his brother Haran and others arrived at a way station, if you will, or a midpoint between Ur of the Chaldees and the Promised Land. and lived there for some period of time before, Willie, would you let Pastor Davis in the door? Don't want to leave him standing in the rain, although I guess he's out of the rain at the moment. So they had a midpoint, if you will, where they spent some time, and then later Abram and his family moved on to Canaan, the land of Canaan, which God, of course, was promising and which he proceeded to deliver to him. And so we find Abram simply departing. He didn't say, "Oh, I don't think I want to do that," or, "Yeah, that's a problem," or, "Why would you want to do that, God?" Now, maybe Abram had some second thoughts. We don't know. But based on his later ability to sacrifice his own son Isaac, we can only imagine that Abram probably did pretty much what it says here in verse 4. So Abram departed as the Eternal had spoken to him. He just got up and went and did as he was told. So later we find, of course, Abram being promised other things, and we'll come to those in a moment. But let's look at this set of promises first. Get out from your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. So he's taking him to a new place. And then he says, I will make you a great nation. I will make you a great nation. That's a physical, national promise. This doesn't have to do with our spiritual understanding of salvation and the church today. This is a physical promise of national capacity. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. So Abram's name was going to become great. His nation was going to become great, and he was going to become a blessing to the world around him, even to the point that God said, I will curse him that curses you. So God's work in the world for a period of time was going to revolve around Abraham and how people treated Abraham. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So there is a promise of national capacity and greatness, along with a recognition that the rest of the world would enjoy blessings as a result of Abraham's blessings. Now, we could belabor this, but let's jump forward to Genesis 17. Hit some of the highlights here. Genesis 17, verse 1. Now, this is after several events in Abram's life and his attempt to try to work things out his and Sarai's way. But chapter 17, verse 1, when Abram was 99 years old, the Eternal appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless. So there had to be some kind of law involved, didn't there? There had to be some kind of expectations and commandments to keep. So that Abraham could learn how to walk and to be blameless, which of course would also include mercy and forgiveness. So there was law and there was grace, clear back in the days of Abram. Verse 2, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. Multiply you exceedingly. This is a little more specific and a little more numerical than what we saw back in great nation statement. I will multiply you exceedingly. Then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you. What's called the Abrahamic covenant today. My covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. Now we move from him being a great nation, I will make of you a great nation, to God saying to him, I will make you the father of many nations. So many nations are going to come out of Abraham's loins, and they are going to be blessed because of Abraham's blessing, and they, of course, are going to be a blessing to the other nations of the earth. Verse 6, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. So again, this is a physical blessing of physical inheritance, physical descendants, and the promises that God has given to Abraham are going to be shared with future generations. Verse 7, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants. Your descendants. So this is not just a personal thing with Abram. It's going to go to his descendants as well. After you in their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also, I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So God gave Abram what he said he would give him, changed his name to Abraham, and now gives him the land of Canaan for himself and his descendants. Now, this sounds like God is working with Abram alone at this point, that he has begun to work with Abram like he might have worked with Adam in the Garden of Eden, had Adam participated, and that he may be working with Abram alone. Now, God doesn't always tell us those things. We don't always know exactly what's happening on the outside of the picture, but when God gives us a picture that's this clear and this definitive, you would have to conclude that God is not working with other people in other places. He's working with Abram, and all the nations are going to be blessed by his blessings, and his descendants are going to be blessed according to what God has promised him. You don't see other people around the periphery who are being given this. It is a covenant between God and Abraham. Verse 9, God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. So God said, let's seal the deal here, and you will be my people, and I will work with you and your children for future generations. In fact, he says, I will establish it after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant. So that covenant continues today. That covenant has not been breached by God, because he said, I have made it with you, and it's going to be an everlasting covenant. So our blessings flow from God's fulfillment of these promises to Abraham. Let's go on over to the story most of us know best, and that is, of course, Abraham's call to sacrifice his own son Isaac in order to, in a sense, prove his obedience to God. Genesis chapter 22. We know the story pretty well, so I'm not going to go through the details of the story. Remember in verse 1, God calls to Abraham, and he says, here I am. And he says to him, verse 2, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Tradition says, and we believe basically, that the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is where Mount Moriah was at the time. So Abraham rose early in the morning, and I'm not going to again go through the details, but he went. He did what God told him to do. And God had told him to sacrifice Isaac, and so he came to the place where he prepared to sacrifice Isaac, and Isaac himself wondered, where's the offering? Verse 9, then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Now, we have to explain this to young people sometimes, because it seems pretty harsh, and yet, of course, God had a purpose for it, but he also had a solution for it, an out. And Abraham had actually prophesied that unknowingly and unintentionally when he told Isaac that God would provide a lamb for a burnt offering. But he stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Eternal called him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know. Critical point here. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Now, thankfully, God does not do that today, and only on a rare occasion do we see some demonic activity in the world in which people seem to believe that God does do that and that they are responsible for such activity. But we do not believe that occurs today, or that anyone should ever accept some foul spirit guiding them to do something as tremendous as this. This was God talking to Abraham, and Abraham knew that it was God. But he said, "You have not withheld your son, your only son." Verse 15, "Then the angel of the Eternal called to Abraham a second time out of heaven," and this angel, as it's called here, is probably Christ himself, "and said, 'By myself I have sworn, says the Eternal, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son.'" So now there's a cause and effect relationship. Because you have done this. Because, in other words, you have shown me that you fear God. Because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies." Now, if you travel in the Middle East, and particularly in Israel, you see lots of cities of old in the archaeological digs and so forth, where they had these massive columns and gates, and clearly possessing the gate of your enemy would control the city. But there are other scriptures and examples which lead us to believe that these gates of their enemies are also any of the choke points, as we might call them militarily, around the world, which allow Abraham's children to control much of the commerce and the warfare of the entire world. And that has been the case with the children of Abraham in modern times. Verse 18, "In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." Now before, remember, he said, "In you all the families of the earth will be blessed." It's worded slightly differently in Genesis 12 when he said, "In you will all the families of the earth be blessed." Now he says, "In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men. They rose and went together to Beersheba. So the incident is over, but God has said, "Now I know that you fear God. And because you have done this thing, I will bless you abundantly, and I will cause all of these things to happen, including descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore." So Abraham received a promise of great blessings, including the fact that in his seed all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Now, if we take a moment to pause to go over to Galatians chapter 3 here, Galatians chapter 3. In verse 7 of Galatians 3, Paul says, "Therefore know that only those who are of faith are sons of Abraham." Now, this is on the spiritual level that he's talking about, and we'll see that in a moment. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, "In you all the nations shall be blessed." So there is a spiritual promise here as well, which Paul goes on to point out. So those who are of faith are blessed with believing Abraham. Coming down to verse 16. "Now to Abraham and his seed," and in my Bible, seed is capitalized properly. "To Abraham and his seed were the promises made." He does not say "and to seeds." So this is not a promise having to do with the descendants of Abraham being a blessing to people. This is a promise having to do with one seed, as Paul says. He does not say "and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ." So by looking at that and understanding that, we have a clue to recognizing that God gave both physical promises of wealth and abundance to Abraham and power among the nations. In him all nations would be blessed. But he also gave him a promise that his seed, Christ, would be the author of salvation and spiritual blessings to all people. So we're looking at both a physical blessing and a spiritual blessing coming through Abraham. And it's important to note that, because they get separated later on in the lives of his children. Let's go back now to chapter 15 of Genesis. We read there earlier that Israel possessed the land of Canaan. But here where we have Abram meeting with Melchizedek, who of course is also Christ, the King of Peace. Verse 18, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So Abraham is blessed by, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong chapter. That all ties in, but it's not exactly what I was looking for. Let's go to chapter 15, verse 18. On the same day, the Eternal made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. So that is far more than the Palestine that we think of today. The Euphrates, of course, is way over there in Iraq today. But God said, I have given you this land from the river of Egypt, that is the Nile, all the way to the river Euphrates. And he mentions all the different ites that are inhabiting the land who are going to be removed. So this was not just a promise that Abraham would be able to inherit the little strip of Canaan. And even when Israel came out of Egypt and went in and took the land, if you look at Bible maps, you will see that they took much more than is currently part of the land of Israel or Palestine today. They were able to take a good bit of what God had previously given them in the person of Abraham. All right, moving forward again, I just wanted to back up and pick that up because it shows that this was a bigger piece of land than Palestine, and that it had to do with Abraham having tremendous blessings as a nation. We go on to chapter 26, verse 3, God says to Abraham, dwell in this land and I will be with you and bless you, for to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. So now he's talking to Isaac. Verse 1 makes that clear. He's talking to Isaac. God appeared to him and told him, dwell here in this land, and I will bless you and your descendants according to what I promised your father Abraham. So the blessings, the promises get passed on to Isaac from Abraham. Going on in verse 4, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. That same seed, Jesus Christ, who is going to come as the Savior of mankind. And what here it is again, verse 5, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So even today, you and I are enjoying some of the blessings, all of the blessings really, that we possess because Abraham obeyed God. If you ever get to wondering and thinking, is it all that important that I obey God? After all, I'm willing to, quote, give up my salvation. You know, sometimes that kind of thought crosses your mind. You think I could give away my part. I hope you never think that, but Satan puts that in our minds from time to time. Then you have to stop and say, but wait a minute. What I have today, I have because Abraham obeyed God, and what future generations, however many there may be, are going to have, is going to happen because I obey God, because we obey God, because we believe that God is going to fulfill his promises to the end of the age. And we're not just here for our own salvation in that sense. We're also here to share God's way with those who come after us. So Isaac receives the same promise with slight additions or explanations that God had given to Abraham. And he says it's because Abraham obeyed my voice. Now we come to chapter 27. And, of course, Isaac's son, Jacob. Skipping over some of the very interesting but unusual stories about Esau and Jacob, we come to the point of this part of the story. In chapter 27, verse 26. This is Isaac blessing Jacob after Jacob has taken Esau's birthright away from him and is now coming in and pretending to be Esau with goat's hair on his body and all these strange experiences that come in here. And Isaac says to Jacob in verse 26, his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and now and kiss me, my son." And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing and blessed him and said, "Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field." He thought it was Esau, which the Eternal has blessed. "Therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine." Now we get more specific promises. You notice that? Now, it doesn't just say you're going to be a blessing. It doesn't just say you're going to be blessed. It doesn't just say you're going to possess the gates of your enemies. It says you're also going to have abundance. "May God give you of the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you." That first, of course, happened when the children of Israel came to bow down to Joseph in Egypt. But it also has happened down through the last couple of hundred years as history finally came to catch up with these promises. "Let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you." Remember that from the original promise to Abraham. He said, "I will curse him who curses you. And blessed be those who bless you." So Isaac blesses Jacob. And even though he believed it to be Esau, God honored the blessing, and in fact, Isaac later told Esau, "I'm sorry, your brother came and stole your blessing away from you." So the history of Abraham's children is not all pretty. It's not all honorable and uplifting, and the history of Israel is fraught with all kinds of human problems and sins. And even Jesus Christ, who is the son of Abraham and the son of Israel through Judah, is from a genealogy, when you look at it, that contains all kinds of folks that you might be surprised are in the genealogy of Christ. From harlots to deceivers to murderers, Christ descended from a long line of people who did not necessarily obey God. But the promise was to Abraham's children because Abraham obeyed, not because Abraham's children necessarily obeyed any more than they are obeying God in the world today. So Jacob inherits the blessing. So now we have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jacob, of course, loses Joseph to Egypt. And ultimately, we have to look at Joseph's situation. But let's stay here with Jacob for a moment in chapter 28. Chapter 28, verse 13, the story of Jacob's ladder, told in Sunday schools and probably Sabbath schools all over the world. But Jacob's ladder story finds Jacob dreaming. Verse 13, "Behold, the Eternal stood above it and said, 'I am the Eternal God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants.'" The land on which you lie. I remember many years ago Mr. Armstrong making the comment that he had talked to some critic who had actually said, "Well, that's only as much space as his body took. You know, God promised to give him the land on which he was lying. That's 2x6. That'd be a great promise, wouldn't it? You stand right here for the rest of your, and your descendants can live right here on this 2x6 piece of land for the rest of time. The land on which you lie, meaning, of course, the location in which he found himself. Keep getting lost in my scriptures here, can't see. Verse 14, "Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south, and in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed." spread abroad to the east and the west and the north and the south, and all the families of the earth are going to have contact with Abraham's descendants. So this is a major part of world history we're talking about here. God is going to provide everything Abraham and his descendants could ever need or would ever want to have. So God was with Abraham, he was with Isaac, he was with Jacob. Again, let's pause and go over to Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4, verse 13. This is in a long, complex Paulinian context, so I'll just take out verse 13 here from Romans chapter 4. The heading in my Bible says, "The promise granted through faith." Verse 13, "For the promise that he would be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith." Now, we could spend the time talking about the righteousness of faith, but the point I want to make here is it says the promise that he would be the heir of the world. Now, that obviously in one sense is both physical and spiritual, because Abraham's going to be part of the family of God. He's mentioned in the book of Hebrews. But Abraham was going to, in a sense, inherit the world, because God said he's going to spread abroad from the east and the west, the north and the south, and all nations are going to be blessed in Abraham. So it confirms certainly that the promise was not limited to the land of Canaan, or the land of Palestine, or even over to the Euphrates. All right, we move forward then again to Genesis 35, where Jacob is again given additional information. Genesis 35, verse 9, "Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, 'Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name.' So he called his name Israel." And as you know from various footnotes and explanations, the term means prevailer with God. Jacob had wrestled with Christ and wouldn't let him go. When he blessed him, he said, "Your name will be called Israel." From that time forward, Jacob, though sometimes referred to as Jacob still in the scriptures, is Israel to God. So when we talk about Israel and the children of Israel, we're talking about Jacob, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham. And when we talk about Israel in Old Testament terms, up until this point, we're talking about Jacob's, that is Israel's, children, all 12 of them in the following verses of this chapter. But of course, after this, Joseph, the son of Israel, is sold into slavery and goes down to Egypt. Now again, there were the 12 sons of Israel. Again, you have to think of Jacob as Israel and Israel as Jacob. They are one and the same. The 12 sons of Jacob, the 12 sons of Israel. And Joseph was sold by his brothers into slavery in Egypt and ended up in Egypt, of course, in Pharaoh's house, and ended up in various places, and ended up, of course, being the second ruler, if you will, in all of Egypt. But we fast forward a bit here to Genesis chapter 48, because a major change takes place here. What we've seen is this inheritance of the promises and the blessings coming down from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. But now the firstborn of Jacob is Reuben, who would inherit those promises under normal circumstances. But that doesn't happen. A major event takes place here, and it's explained as well in other places, but in Genesis chapter 48, let's pick this up in verse 3, where Jacob says to his son Joseph, Jacob says to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me in Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. and said to me, Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you a multitude of people, and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. All right, so far so good. We've read all of that. Verse 5, And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Remember, Jacob had come down after the intrigue with the brothers and the feed sacks and the food sacks and all those things. And Jacob is now talking to Joseph and saying, You have two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt. And they actually, of course, were part Egyptian. Before I came to you, they are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. So Jacob here makes Joseph's two children his heirs. Joseph, of course, has been in Egypt and remains in Egypt to die. And so there is no direct fulfillment of the blessings to Joseph in the sense of having his own land and the nation, but he rules the land of Egypt. But God takes Ephraim and Manasseh, his children, and says, They're mine. Verse 6, Your offspring whom you beget after them shall be yours. They will be called after the name of their brothers in inheritance. But as for me, he goes on to say, all of these things happened. And verse 8 goes back and describes it more thoroughly. And then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, Who are these? Joseph said to his father, They are my sons whom God has given me in this place. And he said, Please bring them to me and I will bless them. Now you know this story, but again, it's important to keep this in our minds. The eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought to see your face, but in fact God has also shown me your offspring. So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed them down with them to the face of the earth. Then Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. He brought Manasseh to Israel's right hand because Manasseh was the older. Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. So the right hand should have gone on Manasseh's head, but Israel crossed his hands and put his right hand on Ephraim and his left hand on Manasseh. And he blessed Joseph, that is, Joseph in the persons of his children. God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, both of them, Ephraim and Manasseh. Bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them. Now, this is one of the truths that virtually nobody ever sees or knows, but once you see it and understand it, it, of course, makes perfect sense. Let my name be named upon them and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So now the promise that came to Abraham was passed down to Isaac, was passed down to Jacob, who became Israel, and Israel is now talking to his grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh, and he is asking God to bless them and put his name on them. So Ephraim and Manasseh at this point become Israel. Now, today, we think we can track most of the descendants of ancient Israel and the 12 tribes. And Christ talked, of course, about the 10 lost tribes. We think we can track them and know pretty much where they are in the world. But you know what? They're Jacob's sons. But they are not identified truly as Israel today. Think about that for a moment. Issachar or Reuben or Benjamin or any of those are not identified as Israel. They're sons of Jacob, but Israel gave his name to Ephraim and Manasseh and with it the inheritance. He said, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So he took the promises that God had given him that came down from Abraham and Isaac, and he passed them on in this blessing to his grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh. Verse 17, now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, so he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. Here we are again with man trying to intervene in what God is actually doing. You know, you'd have to ask yourself, what was Joseph thinking? Of course, he was the ruler of the country. But what was he thinking when he saw his father reach out and cross his hands to these children? Did he think that was accidental? Of course he did. He said, wait a minute, you got it mixed up here. Your heart of seeing here, your eyesight's dim. But Israel said, verse 19, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he shall be great. That's important to us because that people is us. That people is we. That people are you. That people is the United States of America. He shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. So right here in this little section, we have Israel blessing the children of Joseph and saying they're going to become a nation and a whole multitude of nations. Other translations render it various ways. Moffat calls it a nation and a group of nations. Well, if we look today at a nation and a group of nations who have dominated the world in the last 200 years, and there's a reason why it's only been 200 years, we find, of course, the United States and the British Commonwealth. Verse 20, so he blessed him in that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. So the blessing was passed on to the grandsons of Israel, and Ephraim and Manasseh inherited all of those blessings that God gave to Abraham. Now, the many, many more details to the story, I don't have time to go through here, but suffice to say that Ephraim and Manasseh became the heirs of the physical promises to Abraham. None of the rest of the tribes of Israel are included in these promises, though in many cases we see them having been blessed to a certain degree, even as God said, in some cases the younger would be blessed. But these promises are exclusive to Ephraim and Manasseh. And both the tribes were blessed with the blessings of Jacob. And those two became Britain and the United States, which is another matter in terms of trying to go through the historical details and prove. Why the 200 years? Well, because God had told Israel when they went into captivity that the blessings would be withheld for seven times, which comes out to 2,520 years. So from 700 roughly B.C., 721 until around 1800 to 1803 A.D., those blessings were withheld, but they were poured out on Britain and the United States beginning at the beginning of the 19th century. So America and Britain became the greatest nations on the face of the earth, and of course a multitude of nations in the case of the British Commonwealth, and have dominated the world, generally speaking, for the last 200 years, until now we start to see deterioration. Over the last 30 or 40 years, Britain's empire has collapsed completely, and Britain is no longer in charge of as much of the world as it once was. In fact, basically is only its little island kingdom now. America has begun to lose the pride of its power, which God said that it would, and our leadership says we are not an exceptional nation. We should be like everybody else. We shouldn't have all this wealth. We shouldn't live like we do. We should humble ourselves and be like everybody else in the world. And so once again, man tries to intervene and undo what God himself has done. Now again, as I didn't want to say that God had inspired Francis Scott Key, neither would I say directly that God inspired what I'm about to read to you, but I can certainly imagine that some of it is possibly inspired. We fast forward again 150 years to the United States and to President Abraham Lincoln reminding the nation of the source of our blessings, though I doubt that he understood that we were Manasseh, or that we were Israel for that matter, but he understood the source of our blessings and so stated. Now, this is often called a Thanksgiving proclamation, but it wasn't exactly that. There was a Thanksgiving proclamation a few months later that included some of the same material, but he said it best in this proclamation, which was a proclamation of a fast day for America to humble itself and repent before God and thank God for their blessings. And this was issued on April the 30th, 1863, of course, at the height of the Civil War. And in this proclamation, among other things that he said, President Lincoln said, "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity." I remember Francis Scott Key talked about preserving the nation. "Preserve these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown." No, because no other nation was given the promises that this nation was given. "But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us." End quote. So Abraham Lincoln called the nation to repentance and to prayer and to ask God to bless us in the midst of that horrible war. But he said, "We have had unbroken success, and as a result, we've become self-sufficient." Did God warn Israel about that? Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6. We normally turn here to talk about the Shema, as we call it, the loving God with all our hearts, and then teaching that to our children, which is covered in the first six or seven verses. And then we come down to Deuteronomy 6, verse 10. And God says, or Moses says on God's behalf, "So shall it be when the Eternal your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Now this is the first time when he brought them out of Egypt, but now he's brought us into this land of America. "To give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build." This was, of course, in the case of ancient Israel taking over the nations that existed in Canaan. But the attitude is what we're looking at here. The example is them going into Canaan and receiving what other nations had already done. "Houses full of all good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. When you have eaten and are full," what did President Lincoln say? When we become too self-sufficient. "When you have eaten and are full, then beware lest you forget the Eternal who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage." Beware lest you forget. We in America are in danger of forgetting, and more we live in a secular society that does not like to acknowledge a true God. It likes to acknowledge the idea of a God, but not a God who controls our destiny and to whom we must look and pray and obey. We in God's church, who are spiritual Israel, an entirely different but much more pertinent to us subject, spiritual Israel, certainly cannot forget that we are also physical Israel and that God has provided everything we have, that all credit belongs to God, not to us. We didn't do it. We didn't build it. It's not our greatness, not our soldiers, not our wars, not our goodness. It's what God has provided for us because he said to Abraham, "I am going to bless you above all nations on the face of the earth." You and I don't really celebrate the 4th of July as many people do, yet it is not a pagan holiday dedicated to the God of war, as we might suspect. It's simply a memorial of our wars, and particularly of the Battle of Fort McHenry. We might even enjoy the fireworks display or other events the 4th of July sometimes includes. I remember driving my antique car in a parade in Big Sandy one 4th of July. It's a national holiday. It's an event that remembers what has happened down through our history. So it doesn't necessarily contradict God's law, as long as we are careful to make sure we don't participate in things that do contradict God's law. But it's a national observance that harks back to when God separated us from Ephraim and allowed us to have independence in this nation so that we could then inherit the blessing of the single nation that God promised Abraham, a great nation and a company of nations. So God gave us the blessings of Abraham, which had been withheld for 2,520 years, and we enjoy them today. So do we as God's people, God's church, spiritual Israel, understand who we are both nationally and spiritually? Do you understand why we live where we live and why we enjoy the blessings that we enjoy today? That we are the physical children of Abraham who obeyed God and through whom our blessings came? Do we realize that we have been given the richest blessings of the earth? I hope that we do, and I hope that if we do, we are regularly and constantly giving all credit and glory, not to our forefathers, not to our war machines, not to our politicians, but that all credit and glory go to the Creator God, the God who promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Ephraim, and Manasseh all these wonderful blessings that we enjoy today. I hope we thank God for those, for the lives we enjoy in this free country.